Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, where you can download our podcasts on iTunes for free.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Pretty good. Pretty good.
I'm pretty good as well. Hey, listen out there, if you're interested in learning a little bit more about wine, we have the Stage Left Wine Course, which I've been teaching for 15 years now. It's probably the preeminent wine class in Jersey.
Really long time.
It runs for 6 weeks. You can find out more about it on the website of Stage Left Restaurant. I have a couple of great wine events coming up in January. We have Blake Spaulding and Jennifer Castle, who own Hell's.
You've heard right here on this show.
They own Hell's Backbone Grill in Boulder, Utah, and they've published an awesome book, which is also a great present for the holidays, which is called A Measure of Grace. It's, mm-hmm. And we're cooking from their book. They're going to come to a book signing. We've got some wines paired with it. You can find out all about that at stageleft.com, which, of course, you can link to through restaurantguysradio.com.
So, Francis, it's out of the bag, a long-time, well-known restaurant secret.
Actually, a not-so-well-known secret.
Well, but
we
but
knew.
Known by people in the restaurant business is out of the bag. Frank Bruni outed one of our favorite restaurants.
Frank Bruni is the restaurant critic for the New York Times and one of the oldest restaurants and one of the oldest continuously operating and very great restaurant, a favorite of ours, is called Keen's Steakhouse, once called Keen's Chop House, mm-hmm. in Manhattan. He gave them 2 stars in the New York Times, which is a pretty darn good review for a steakhouse.
I think that's pretty appropriate, too.
But here, let me read to you from the beginning of the article. Keen's is known famously for their mutton chop. Okay, it's the only place in New York where you can go to get a mutton chop.
Yep.
And they make their own homemade mint jelly.
The best mint jelly you've ever had in your life.
The whole wide
world. I am so, like, don't put mint jelly on your lamb unless it's Keen's mint jelly.
Real, not artificial anyway.
You can see the little pieces of mint inside the jelly. It's really great.
And the rooms at Keen's are great. I love it there. I do parties there once in a while if I'm going to meet people, mm-hmm. in Manhattan. Anyway, here's the beginning. There's a secret to the surprising mellowness of the legendary mutton chop at Keen's Steakhouse, a restaurant long synonymous with that gargantuan slab of meat. It's their signature dish. There's simple reason it has none of the gaminess that diners expect of mutton. Mutton, which is sheep, and instead this reminds them of lamb, the younger version that we know and trust. The mutton lore is a mutton lie. For at least 20 years and perhaps many more, the legendary mutton chop has indeed been a matter of legend. The following sentence is inevitable as the one on its tail. Diners have had the wool pulled over their eyes.
Oh. Not so much a mutton lie as a mutton exaggeration, we'll say.
Here's the deal. Mutton is an older sheep.
Right.
Lamb is younger. And mutton tastes sort of gamey.
Mm-hmm.
And
frankly, I mutton tends to get into unpleasant.
It's a little
over the top.
It's a little much.
As opposed to lamb, which even for some people, lamb is over the top. I happen to love lamb. And I will tell you, I don't care, mutton, lamb, whatever you want to call it, Keen's Chop House or Keen's Steakhouse, again, whatever you want to call it, has the best lamb that I've ever had in my life.
So here's what happened. The Keen's Chop House, which has been around for over 100 years, it became famous for this mutton chop. Well, during World War II, lamb is always more expensive than mutton. Lamb became really rare, and so for a while there,
I like my lamb rare.
Mutton was all you mutton was all you could get, and so you had a lot of mutton. And then after World War II, when the GIs came back, the taste for mutton really diminished. And you pretty much can't get mutton in the United States. It's very difficult to find mutton. It's all lamb. And so it's been a signature dish for them for 50 or 60 years. So what they did was they just had a lamb. Now, it's not your normal lamb. They had lamb at 10 months old, which is older than most lamb is slaughtered in the United States. And they have it cut in a very thick chop that looks sort of like a mutton chop. Mm-hmm. And they just call it mutton chop.
but it's so good, Francis.
The way Mark and I found out about this.
I don't care what they call it. It's so good.
The way Mark and I found out about
this. It is the best of the best. And when we talk about this show, one of the, you know, in our intro, we talk about the finer things in life. This is the finest lamb that I've ever had anywhere in the world.
It's
so
singular.
Lamb or mutton, whatever you want to call it. It's my favorite.
Well, and it's singular, and it's really it's worth the trip to go to Keene's Steakhouse. And we've served this chop in the restaurant at Stage Left for special occasions once or twice over the last 10 or 12 years. I don't want to steal somebody else's chop. But we had a friend who worked there, and we wanted to do it for a special dinner where we wanted lamb and, for some reason, mincelli. So we made our own mincelli, which I think was akin to theirs. But we called them up, and we said, now, where do you get mutton chop? And we looked all around, and we're pretty good at sourcing things, and we couldn't find mutton. And people said, why do you want mutton? So we found the supplier to Keene's, who finally came clean with us.
Who outed them to us a few years back.
Said, yeah, it's not really mutton, Francis. Nobody wants mutton. And I was like, no, first the Tooth Fairy, then Santa Claus, now this. So, but what it is it's lamb, but from an older lamb and a very thick piece of meat. It's done really beautifully, and I really recommend Keene's a lot. The other interesting thing about Keene's Chop House, here we are plugging another restaurant on our show.
Okay, that's part of what we do.
But I love it. Keene's Chop House has these private rooms, two private rooms, and it's steeped in tradition. The one private room is called
the Bull Moose Room,
because there's a big moose head hanging over the side. And there's legend out there, I don't know whether it's urban legend, I think it is urban legend, that that's where Teddy Roosevelt started the Bull Moose Party. I think that's false. But what's,
oh, I could be.
But what's really true is the other private room, and I've held events in these rooms, they're great. Simple. I mean, steakhouse, right? I mean, simple, really
straightforward.
Good food.
Straightforward. Very, very straightforward steakhouse.
Good wine list, great scotch list. But the other room is called the Lily Langtree Room. And Lily Langtree was a stage actress in New York. And she broke the gender barrier. It used to be that women weren't allowed in bars and taverns and restaurants, really. And Lily Langtree made it her hangout. She walked right in into Keene's and was a regular there, and she was the most famous stage actress of her day. And they have the Lily Langtree Room. You know what else they have there that's really interesting?
What else do they have there that's really interesting?
And it's mentioned in the review.
Tell us.
They have an antique. They have the playbill that Abraham Lincoln was holding when he was shot.
At Keene's Chop House in New York.
Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play? There we recommend it. Two stars, Keene's Chop House, New York City. We'll link them on our website. You can go check them out. We'll give another restaurant some free press.
They're the only restaurant in the world that has pipes all over the ceiling, but you can't smoke a pipe in them.
Yeah, the tradition came that people used to smoke clay pipes. Were very popular in New York. And so they had a pipe club, and all the people would keep their pipes there. And so you have, like, Theodore Roosevelt had a pipe there.
And there are thousands and thousands of pipes.
50,000 pipes.
From famous people from throughout history.
Are hanging on the ceiling. And when someone dies, they would leave their pipe. When a regular member dies, they'd leave their pipe up there. Well, now you can't smoke any longer.
Right.
But actually, when I was there last time, they sell clay pipes.
Yes.
I bought a clay pipe.
You did? I remember.
Absolutely.
But it's almost a museum. It's almost become a museum, that this restaurant, and that's what
happens. Yeah, but it's not hokey at all. Mm-hmm. It's very real.
But still serving real food. But that's what I think a great old 100-year-old restaurant is, almost like a museum. When you talk about the types of people, the people who go through a restaurant, the people who walk into a restaurant, the people that you meet when you're at a restaurant. You know, all this talk about Rosa Parks. You know, I got to meet Rosa Parks because I worked in a great restaurant back in the 80s. You know, those are the kinds of things that happen in great restaurants. Everybody goes to great restaurants. Everybody.
Yeah. Well, and they say some of the old members that whose pipes are hanging or Teddy Roosevelt, and Babe Ruth has a pipe up there. And it's ironic.
History. It's history. That's exactly what it is.
It's ironic that you can't smoke up there, but let me tell you something. I did buy one of those clay pipes. I'm not really a big smoker, but I thought I'd give it a whirl. Absolutely a boring way to smoke. No flavor in the clay pipes at all.
So you're going for the more traditional pipe anyway.
I just, you know, once a month I have a cigar. That's my thing.
And it's a big vice.
And it's a shame. We used to go to Keene's, and we used to stay afterwards and smoke cigars in their private room, and you can't do it anymore. I wish that were not the case, but
it is what it is.
Life goes on. We're coming back in just a moment. We're going to be talking with Brian Halliwell, who's written a great book called Eat Here, about local product, about local producers, about eating locally, about eating sustainably and eating well. And we'll be talking with him in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. And we have a special guest with us today. Brian Howell-Weil is a senior researcher at World Watch, an advocacy and research group, where he's a resident expert on coffee, food, sustainable agriculture, organic farming, and biotechnology. He's been published in the Washington Post, the L.A. Times, the New York Times. He's been called to testify before the United States Senate, and he joins us today to discuss his book, Eat Here. Hi, Brian. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for coming today.
Sure.
It's a real pleasure. I actually, we saw your book reviewed, and then we were intrigued by it and invited you to come on the show, and then our producer told us 2 days ago that you were coming on the show, and so Mark and I crammed for this. But the book was a great read, and it talks about mostly eating locally. And, you know, one of the things we talk about on this show all the time is how having great taste is really revolutionary and leads to a good result. Very often, you know, with food, eating well, you do, by doing good, you do well. And by doing well, you do good. I mean,
you actually get better food by sourcing
right, by having good taste and looking for better food and being better to yourself, you do better for the world. Is that a paradigm that you find that works?
Oh, most definitely. And eating local, you know, I often say it's the easiest way to improve your diet. It's the easiest way to cut out a ton of processed and junk and prepared foods from your diet, because you're going to tend to depend more on raw ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to be getting as much added fat and sugars. It's the easiest way in the world to reduce the environmental impact of the food you eat. That is, the food's not being trucked thousands mm-hmm. of miles at great cost to air quality and our roads and congestion.
Well, let's talk for a second about that. Let's talk about food miles. That's been getting a little bit of press lately. Let's talk a little bit about what exactly that means.
People are all up in arms because they say our food is flying all over the planet and being shipped long distances. Why is that a bad thing?
Well, it's a bad thing for a number of reasons. I think the most obvious one is that it takes a tremendous amount of energy to move all this food around. You know, food is dense. It's got a lot of water in it, and so it requires a tremendous amount of oil primarily to move our food around. In the book, I summarize all sorts of statistics, and if you look at food trade around the world between countries, the amount of food we're shipping around the planet, that is the volume of food we're shipping around the planet, has gone up fourfold in the last half century, since around 1950. And mm-hmm. this increase is not just explained by the fact that we have more people on the planet, because in that same time, the population only doubled. So everyone, everywhere, is depending on food coming from farther and farther away. And that's using a tremendous amount of energy. And if you think about the typical meal that you eat, you know, some grains, some meat, some vegetables, some fruit, the typical meal put together from long-distance ingredients is going to use at least four times as much energy as the same meal put together from local ingredients, and that's primarily for transportation. And so
how are they keeping the food prices down then? How's that?
It seems counterintuitive. What we're saying is that, well, we're spending all this money on oil and to move stuff around. Why is it cheaper to buy stuff from Uruguay than it is to buy it from the local farmer?
Well, it can sometimes seem like a bit of a contradiction and a bit surprising. The first reason is that the cost of energy is artificially cheap. That is, oil, electricity, everything that we move, all the energy sources we use to move food around are relatively inexpensive. And so, you know, what you pay for a loaf of bread or a gallon of milk, the share of that price that goes to transportation is tiny. We're talking about pennies on the dollar. So
mm-hmm.
even if the price of oil were to double or triple, it probably wouldn't make that big a dent in the cost of shipping something. So that's the reason why an apple shipped all the way from Chile to Seattle can sometimes cost less in the supermarket than an apple grown in Washington State.
Which is just crazy. I mean, just crazy that you can live in Washington State and be buying Chilean apples during apple season in Washington.
And the bottom line is that it's not cheaper. Yes, it is cheaper mm-hmm. at the checkout counter, but it's
right.
not cheaper in terms of the impact on the atmosphere of shipping those apples. It's not cheaper in terms of the impact of the quality of that food. The apple's not going to be as fresh and healthy. Often it's going to have to be fumigated and treated with preservatives. And it's not cheaper for that apple farmer in your backyard who's now lost a market. So
who may go away.
Exactly. And then you never have the option of buying that fresh apple.
I also think that when we talk about cheaper, we're not talking – there are costs that come on the back end, and those are never factored into the costs of the apple that you're buying. Whether it's health insurance, whether it's subsidizing a farmer in your backyard because he can no longer compete, there are all those hidden costs on the back end.
And there's an important issue of scale that we sometimes ignore. A giant apple farmer in New Zealand, let's say, who's producing literally millions of bushels of apples each year, can afford to sell each of those bushels at a much lower price than, let's say, the apple farmer in New Jersey or Vermont, who's only growing a few thousand, producing a few thousand
and
bushels each year.
He may have people working for him making 10 cents an hour.
Well, yeah, that's also another issue is difference in the price of labor. But a relatively small farm needs to charge more per tomato, per apple, because they're only selling 100 pounds of tomatoes or 1,000 pounds of apples.
We have a pretty serious choice to make here. I mean, is the ultimate goal to have the cheapest apple, even if that means that we don't make apples in the United States anymore? I don't think it is. Mark, you don't think it is.
I think we should talk about that more.
And we will in just a moment. We're talking with Brian Hallweil, whose new book, Eat Here, is a really interesting book about eating locally and how we can do well by doing good and get some good food in our bodies. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25. You know, Mark and I are always saying that long-term, good environmental policy and good economic policy are one and the same. And that's not just for the government, it's also for small business and homeowners just like you. To help us put our money where our mouth is, we called E2ECTA. E2ECTA uses a team of specialists to find practical ways for your business or home to conserve energy and even to generate green energy that the utility company then has to buy back from you. That generates a different kind of green for your bottom line. We've gone solar at our restaurants. We're now producing cheap, non-polluting electricity, and with the help of E2ECTA, we did it for very little money. The government programs available to get you set up are unbelievable. We're talking about grants here, not loans, but grants. E2ECTA will help you find the right programs for you, and they'll do the paperwork. You keep the profits. It's a no-brainer, people. For lower energy usage, more profits for yourself, call E2ECTA at 908-359-9300 or click on their link at restaurantguysradio.com. E2ECTA for total energy solutions. Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis from Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. We're here with Brian Hallweil, whose book Eat Here is all about local eating locally and how that does really good things for the planet. We had talked about before the break how the price at the checkout counter does not always reflect the full price of what something costs. And so you make a great analogy in your book where you say, you know, the most economically efficient fuel is coal, as long as you don't take into account the fact that it pollutes the water and pollutes the air and gives people cancer. You know, it's cheapest for the producers. I mean, is that
right? You can't buy tuna anymore, but you have the cheapest fuel that you can buy.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, is that a fair analogy of how agribusiness works? What are the costs that we don't see in the checkout counter? But what are the costs of buying food from far away?
Well, you know, to use the coal analogy, the reason that an apple shipped from New Zealand is cheaper than an apple grown 100 miles away is the only reason that's considered an efficient way to do business, to do the food business, is because we're neglecting all these sorts of costs, the cost of the fuel used to ship it around, the cost of the pollution, the cost of the local economy. And you know, this question of is the goal really to have the cheapest food possible in the supermarket is a good one to ask. And I think it's sort of disrespectful. It's disrespectful to the food. It's disrespectful to the farmers. And it's disrespectful to everyone in the food system. And food as perhaps the most essential thing that we buy on a daily basis, do we really want that to be something that we're constantly trying to find for as as cheap as possible. I mean, you sort of get into this deeper question of what do we want to spend our money on?
Mm-hmm. We want to feed the world. We don't want people to be hungry. But we can do that without shipping food halfway across the planet to people in New Jersey who make $50,000 a year.
Well, exactly.
And also, I mean, if you look at what the race to the bottom is, and I want to talk more with you about the race to the bottom of the price point, what the ramifications of that are, you know, the most efficient way would be for basically America to produce economically right now, the way it's currently structured, it would be eventually for America to grow no food at all. You know, except for maybe soybeans and corn, and frankly not corn when you remove the subsidies, and to just get all our food from elsewhere and have no farms left in America. That is the most economically efficient way, if you look at it in the conventional standard, of what we should do. And so we need to really be very careful of saying, well, if it's 10 cents cheaper if we do it this way, we have to do it, because we don't have to do it that way. And we're going to talk more when we come back with Brian Hallwyl about a different way to look at things and a different way to eat and a way to make a difference that you can take part in when we come back from the break. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey, 1450. WCTC with The Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com. And now you can podcast us for free on iTunes.
Our guest today is Brian Hallwyl. He's a senior researcher at World Watch, an advocacy and research group, where he's a resident expert on coffee, food, sustainable agriculture, organic farming, and biotechnology. He's been published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, and he's even testified before the United States Senate. We're here discussing his book, Eat Here, which talks about eating locally. You know, there seem to be two competing trends, or two opposite trends in the food world. One, Brian, is we look more and more to find the more shelf-stable foods, and more foods from anywhere, branded foods from far away, that are absolutely easy and shelf-stable and marketable. And on the other hand, there is a trend toward eating locally. I mean, if you watch the Food Network, if you go to your local restaurant, we'll talk about what farm the quail came from, where are they Jersey tomatoes in season? How do you look at both of those trends happening at the same time? Are they both happening, and do they butt heads?
I think they butt heads to some extent. But the strange and sometimes funny thing is also that they coexist without ever intersecting whatsoever. I mean, if you look at the American eater, on the one hand, you have the sort of fast food, junk food eater who's struggling with obesity, who often eats by him or herself, who doesn't actually get that much satisfaction out of their food, who's going for the convenience items, those shelf-stable items you spoke about, and is doing more and more of their eating not at home but at convenience stores.
Or in the car.
In the car, exactly. And then on the other side, you have this rapidly growing movement that we'll call the sort of slow food eater, just because it's works so well on the other side from the fast food eater. These are people who are concerned about where their food's coming from, eating a lot more fresh ingredients. These are the people driving the markets in the surging markets in cookbooks and cooking magazines and the surging ratings of the Food Network and
Woo-hoo!
Spin-off products and that sort of thing.
And radio shows like The Restaurant Guys.
Exactly.
And it's sort of ironic that you have, cookbooks are bestsellers and cooking magazine subscriptions are skyrocketing, and that in some ways Americans do less cooking on a day-to-day basis than our grandparents and great-grandparents did. So, I mean, I think to some extent you're talking about two completely different Americans, and it's kind of divided across economic lines.
I don't think it's completely that way, though.
No, not completely.
You also
yeah.
have the person who's doing that 6 days a week and then finally sitting down on Sunday or Saturday and saying, okay, I'm going to have a really good meal now and do better.
Right, and I think that the reason that more and more people are doing just that, taking some time out from the fast food eating habit and moving towards the slow food or local food eating habit, is because It fulfills so many different cravings. I mean, if you think about the people who are interested in eating local, it's everyone from the parent who's dissatisfied with what their kid is being served in school and knows that the school can do better. It's the farmer who's looking to hold on to their livelihood and their land, so they start selling at a farmer's market. It's folks like you guys who know that the best ingredients are going to come when you have some connection to the producer. And so, you know, I think to some extent, eating fresh, eating local, eating seasonal, it's a buzzword, it's a bit fatty, but it's also, I think it's a trend that's here to stay because so many people have a reason to latch on to it.
You know, the big agribusiness feeds us a line all the time when they talk about all the reasons they need to, you know, put antibiotics in food and genetically modify food and have huge agribusiness farms rather than small family farms. They say, listen, there are poor people in Africa, and we need to feed the world. And the only way to feed the world, we have a food crisis looming and a population boom, and the only way to feed the world is to have huge agribusiness firms and ship things from far away.
And put corn in silos and leave it there.
Can you debunk that rumor for us?
Well, I think that it's sort of moral blackmail. I mean, this has been the argument for, let's say, genetically modified crops for the last decade, that yes, there may be some questions, some safety issues, some environmental issues, but without these crops, we will not be able to feed the world. And as you said, the same argument's been made for everything from pesticides to processed foods, and it's simply not true. It's a very misleading argument because, for the most part, agribusiness is not interested in selling food to poor people. That's not where their market is.
Right.
And second, if you look at the causes of hunger around the world, which primarily are linked to poverty or linked to lack of access to land and water, the best hope very often for poorer countries to eradicate hunger is to depend more on what they can produce. They're not likely to be tied into the global food market in a major way. And so if you look at the success stories of hunger around the world, many of them are where governments put more emphasis on helping the farmers in those countries so they could be more self-sufficient.
One of the things you talk about in your book that I think is really interesting is the flood of artificially subsidized, overly cheap agribusiness-produced food often has the
fakely
effect...
Fakely cheap, and that's right. the part that Francis and I really...
Often has the effect of knocking these small farmers in developing countries off their farms because they can no longer afford with the depressed prices to stay on their farms. And
right,
so it not only doesn't feed them, it knocks a local farmer who's producing locally for the local population, keeping local money in the local economy, and it sends him into the slums of the city.
Right. You mentioned before this opinion that some economists have that the United States, because we're a wealthy country, often because we can't produce food as cheaply as other countries, we shouldn't produce any food at all. We should import our food from elsewhere and ship them computers and cars and whatever else we do better. That works on paper. That works in a very theoretical realm and in the sort of dry calculus of economics. It doesn't work in the real world, and some of the sad examples are, let's say in the case of Mexico and the United States, with more and more free trade agreements between the two countries, Mexico has become more and more dependent on American corn. And this is a country that's had corn as the center of its culture for thousands of years, and now it imports a big chunk of its corn from the U.S., which works out when that corn is cheap. But if you have some disruption of the currencies or some change to the Mexican economy, all of a sudden that artificially cheap corn is no longer affordable. And,
right. and they can no longer feed themselves.
Exactly. And all of a sudden, those farmers that previously were raising corn in the Mexican countryside have been driven off the land, and they're not able to feed themselves. So there's a type of security issue associated with keeping farmers on the land. It's not just a romantic nostalgia thing.
Well, let's talk about security issues for a minute, because if you look at it, just at what's going on in Mexico, everybody, is these Mexican farmers who've been growing corn for generations, and it's central to their culture, and growing corn locally and many different varieties of corn, they're being knocked off their land so that we can send them a single type of genetically modified corn that's controlled by one or two companies. And, you know, the ramifications are just incredible for the economy. So, yes, they're getting cheaper corn, but Free trade isn't always free, everybody. If the cheaper corn knocks their local farmers off the farm, that damages their economy. And the big companies say, oh, well, here we're helping out with cheap corn. Your cheap corn is screwing up their economy and knocking poor people off their land.
Well, and it damages in so many ways. It damages in as far as biodiversity, and there are a million things that we can talk about as far as biodiversity. A is just taste. Okay, just I want to have 10 different corns from which to choose. But B is if something happens to that genetically modified corn where it becomes no longer available, where some disease strain attacks it, you have no other corn then in the hopper
In the hopper. I like exactly. that one. In the like hopper. That. Good, yeah. I mean, is that a fair analysis, Brian? Is that?
No, I think it really is. And people will ask the question, why do we need farmers or why do we need small farmers if we can easily produce food in these giant factories? And part of the answer is that having small farmers all over the world, not just in this country and in Mexico and in different parts of Africa, is the best way to preserve food diversity and crop diversity in the field itself. And as you indicated, that crop diversity is our only insurance policy against some new disease that develops, like avian flu or like some new wheat disease that wipes out the very uniform wheat fields that we have in the United States. What crop breeders do when that sort of outbreak happens is they go to the remote parts of the world where farmers are still growing several dozen varieties.
And if those farmers aren't there when we go the next time, we're going to be in a world of hurt. Our guest is Brian Hallweil. He's a senior research executive at World Watch. His book is Eat Here, and you should pick it up. We'll link to it through our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be talking more with him in just a moment about how sometimes the appearance of choice and the appearance of diversity is no diversity at all, and we'll be talking about more about good food in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944. Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. Our guest today is Brian Hallweil. His book is Eat Here. It's about eating locally. And let's remember, everybody, that eating locally is how you get the best food. Mark and I own one of the best restaurants in the state of New Jersey, actually, and another very good restaurant. It's new. We hope it'll be one of the best. Catherine Lombardi and Stage Left. And we buy locally whenever possible. At Catherine Lombardi, our restaurant, our Italian restaurant that we just opened up, we're making our sauce with Jersey tomatoes that we put up in the summer. Why? Well, yeah, we want to support the local farmer. We have a relationship with the farmer that we bought them from. But mostly it's because we think our sauce is better than any other sauce you're going to find because it's tomatoes that we put up sourced locally right here.
That we picked from
Jersey.
The farm in the morning and at 12 o'clock in the afternoon.
2,000 pounds of it.
That was a lot of tomatoes.
Covered in red we were. anyway, one of the interesting things that I think is going on that you discuss in your book, which is there's a statistic that you have in your book where you talk about how agribusiness and the big supermarket seems to offer a lot of choice, but maybe it doesn't offer a lot of choice. You say that the average supermarket has 30,000 items. Half of those items are produced by 10 firms. And on those 10 firms' boards of directors is a total of about 140 people. And so while we have the appearance of choice, imagine if they all had to have, like, a brand name, naming the company on them. Half of the items in your supermarket are produced by 10 – in every supermarket in America are produced by 10 firms. Isn't that a dangerous thing, dangerous to the food supply? It's sort of like Captain Kirk beaming down to the planet with the top of the crew of the Enterprise.
It's dangerous for a lot of reasons. First, because that's a tremendous concentration of power. If you think about who makes the decisions about what sort of food are on, what sorts of foods are on our shelves, that's a very small number of people who obviously have profit primarily as their motivation. But it's a problem for other reasons as well. If there's some new food additive or some new food technology that a bunch of these companies are introducing and they don't necessarily want the public to know about it, or they don't want to do as much work testing it for safety, well, a concentrated group is much easier, is much more able to hide certain things from the public than a spread out group. Mm-hmm. And again, this local food movement is about taking that power back in a lot of ways. It's about making our food system more of a democracy as opposed to, an aristocracy where just a few people are controlling everything.
So is that working? I mean, is agribusiness reacting to the few of us and more of us who are gathering steam? And I say agribusiness, and by that I mean large companies. It doesn't necessarily have to be a bad word. It has been, but it doesn't necessarily have to be.
It has been one of the most exciting things of doing this research over the last few years, is what has started as a very grassroots movement with a blossoming of farmers markets and food buying schemes and restaurants that are buying local and advertising it, are a handful now of what we'd call big food companies, big food conglomerates, who see the writing on the wall and are building some allegiance to local food. And one of the most interesting examples is from just a few months ago, Bon Appetit Management Company, one of the biggest food service companies in the U.S. with about 200 cafes and restaurants all across the country, launched what it called its Eat Local Challenge. And for 1 week, at the end of September, every single one of Bon Appetit's cafes and restaurants had a menu item that was sourced exclusively from within 150 miles of the cafe, what they defined as local. So
right.
Everything from the wheat and the flour for their pastries and breads, the veggies, the meats were all sourced locally. And it was a big hit, and what they concluded was it was a lot easier than they thought it was going to be. Mm-hmm. The chefs had all developed relationships with these farmers, and they didn't want to stop doing it, so it's kind of become an ongoing campaign. And you see examples like that from everyone from Sysco, another mm-hmm. big food distributor, which has begun to do it in a very small way, to companies like Whole Foods, which as it grew, Whole Foods Market,
sure.
which as it grew had lost that connection to place and got a lot of complaints from its conscientious customers, and now has tried to rebuild it.
But as we demand this, and I just absolutely love that this is coming from consumers, this is coming from people, this is coming from our people who are listening to shows like this one and saying, you know what, I want to do a little better, I want to eat a little better, I want to source locally, I want to support that local farmer. This is all in reaction to that. It's all in reaction to you out there in listener land saying, you know what, I'm going to the farmer's market instead of going to Pathmark and buying Chilean apples.
And anyone can do it is the other thing that you're implying. You don't need thousands of people to get together with an organized campaign. Mm-hmm. Setting up a farmer's market in your community takes getting together with three or four farmers and getting your local politician to sign off on it. Changing the sort of food that your local delicatessen carries takes a conversation with the manager. These are little things that can be done all over the world by people in communities everywhere.
And like you said, it's empowering the local consumer. I mean, you as a local consumer can go up and go to your market manager and say, listen, I want organic milk. Listen, I want some produce from local farmers, especially when it's in season. And we are doing that, and it's starting to happen. And it means you've got to educate yourself and know what to ask for, and not always buy just the marketing hype that they feed you. Hey, Brian, we want to thank you for coming on the show, taking the time out of your busy schedule to talk to us.
Thanks
sure,
so much,
it's,
Brian.
It's my pleasure. I've enjoyed chatting with you. Good luck.
Thanks a lot. We're going to put a link up on our website, restaurantguysradio.com, to show you how you can get Brian's excellent book, which hopefully you won't have to cram for overnight, and you can read in a more leisurely pace than Mark and I did. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Our guest today was Brian Hallweil. He's written a great book called Eat Here. It's a great guide talks about why you should eat locally, and of course we think you should eat locally because that's where you get the best food. Use your local farmer's market, come to your restaurant, and tell people that you want to eat local food. You know, there's a great article, a very positive article I saw in a restaurant publication, in Restaurant Biz.
Yeah, we read
magazine.
A lot of these goofy little restaurant publications.
But this was, I sort of leafed through them, but this one really caught my eye. It seems there's a movement among restaurateurs, and you know, when I buy my next car, I'm thinking about doing this. The title of the article is called "Why My Car Smells Like French Fries." Operators are finding alternative fuel in an unlikely place, their fryer.
Yours would actually probably smell like calamari right now.
Yeah, exactly, the Italian restaurant. Check this out. It seems as though people are retrofitting. You may have read this, that it's pretty easy to retrofit a diesel car to run on vegetable oil. Because basically vegetable oil is the same as diesel fuel. It has the same energy. It has the same properties, except that it solidifies it at a higher temperature.
Do you know what we make a lot of in restaurants?
Vegetable oil.
Right.
It turns out you can get a filter, use the spent vegetable oil that you fry things in, and just pour it right in your car. $700 to retrofit your diesel engine with a package from Massachusetts-based Grease Car, and you can have your car run on the fuel from your fryer.
It sounds like a great idea.
Okay, you have to pay to get the grease from your fryer recycled.
Right now, I'm paying somebody to take my fryer oil away so they can recycle, so they can do something with it.
I mean, especially if you're in the restaurant business, you should really look into this. I mean, if you can cut your grease removal costs, and then use that to fuel your car.
There is a little knock on this, though, Francis. There is a little you know, side effect you need to warn people about.
You do wind up smelling like French fries. Well, your car winds up smelling like French fries, hopefully on the outside. That's one of the things we're going to look into. But I think that's absolutely fabulous. And the other thing is, if you run out of the used spent fryer grease, it will also run on regular diesel fuel still, and it will also run on clean vegetable oil, which costs about the same as diesel fuel. And the emissions are much better for the planet. Grease car. I mean, I'm in. I like it a lot. I'm all in. My next car is...
You only get half of the grease if I get one, too.
Yeah, exactly. I better get it first. I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey 1450. The time is 12 noon.